When they had died, their subtler vehicles had left their corpses immediately after death and only their dense body remained, their vitalizing principle which is the seat of sensation floating about near the corpse. Then the body was stolen, and the vitalizing principle made to re-enter it. The servants, then, were mere agglomerates of a body plus a vehicle of sensation, that is to say mere robots possessing a body and sensation, but devoid of feeling, intelligence, and will. Dreadful as this body-snatching practice was, it seemed to be infinitely less tragic than the soul-snatching business going on in the holy city, for the souls of the men who had inhabited them. My whole experience in the city confirmed this opinion. The servants had no intelligence at all. They mechanically repeated certain formulae. They were absolutely devoid of the capacity to think independently and to have emotions. They were body plus sensation and nothing else. In a sense, they were ideal servants. The bodies of the servants were not affected by the fact that their dead bodies had been stolen by the lieutenants of the prince. Daybreak had come and I rose to march on. I had another strenuous and unpleasant day. By coincidence, I lost my whole water supply early in the morning. There was no thunderstorm all day. The afternoon was hotter than usual and I suffered greatly from thirst. With parched lips I lay down in the afternoon and fell asleep. It was nearly nightfall when I awoke. I felt marvelously refreshed. I felt glad, since I had a better chance to keep awake during the time when those confounded magical practices started soon after midnight. The following day I visited one of the monasteries I have mentioned in my earlier book, and again, by coincidence, I had one of my worst experiences. I was nearly found out by the lamas and had to face the ordeal of sitting about motionless for many hours until I could make my escape. Another monastery was visited 2 days later. As is customary in Tibetan monasteries, I was offered holy water to drink. It was impossible to refuse, as all the other pilgrims seemed to be very keen on drinking the holy water, which was offered by a kind of verger. Had I refused, I might have attracted much unwelcome attention. An hour later the holy water produced a very unwelcome reaction, as far as my physical well-being. These vergers, by the way, get the lion's share of the coins collected from pious pilgrims in Tibetan monasteries. I know that the Utpalam Dag, caste royal plant, is known at least in southern Tibet, but I do not suspect the vergers to be so ingenious as to add caste royal to the holy water in order to make some money afterwards by providing certain facilities. Being was concerned, and since the sanitary arrangements in the monastery did not provide the necessary degree of privacy which a Westerner expects as his natural right on certain occasions, an unusual amount of skill and dexterity and all my resourcefulness were required to wriggle out of the difficulty, since I was in the disguise of a Tibetan and had dyed my face and hands only, since my supply of color was exceedingly limited. I then spent a few hours quietly walking about in the monastery, as I was deaf and dumb, in order to hide my foreign accent. I also enjoyed the priceless advantage of not being pestered by the many guides who prey on pilgrims in the Tibetan monasteries, no matter how poor they may be, as they seem to know by experience that the religious poor are always only too glad to let go of their last farthing for religious purposes. I thought how wise Western tourists would be if they adopted the clever practice of posing as deaf and dumb persons when visiting certain guide-infested tourist centers. I had a good look at the Tibetan butter idols. There were idols in the monastery entirely composed of butter mixed with colored earth. They, of course, stood in the shadow, since the afternoons in the summer are dreadfully warm. I had to smile once more when thinking of the fact that idols fight shy of sunshine, since the latter had a tendency to melt them. Was it not symbolical, I thought, that idols could only exert their influence in the shadow and not in bright sunshine. Elaborate ceremonies were performed by Thelamas. An abundant supply of human bones had been used for making censers and other objects used for divine service. I thought of the holy city. The same spirit seemed to reign in the monastery, although in a greatly diluted manner. The lamas distributed pills made of rice to the pilgrims after having consecrated them by elaborate rites. I thought of the temple in the city. The lamas also spoke of the necessity to believe blindly in the contents of their 333 holy books. Just like the members of the Brotherhood in the city, I thought. There, too, the most sublime gift of man, his intelligence, had to be discarded and transcended. They continually spoke, too, of salvation, of saving one's soul by giving it up to the divine. Many, perhaps most, of the conversations at which I had been present in the city, in the dining building and elsewhere, had a distinct parallel in the sermons of the lamas. The prince catered for the elect, the lamas for the multitude, I thought, but I failed to see any fundamental difference between the two. And God's sun shone over the monastery. I thought of the dreadful tragedy of a world in open revolt against its creator. The holy books of dogmatic Buddhism consist of the 108 volumes of the Kanjur and the 225 volumes of the Tanjur, making a total of 333 volumes. In occult numerology, philosophy of abstract figures, the total of the various figures composing a number plays an important part. If we examine the above three numbers, we find that the sum of the figures composing the numbers 108, 225, and 333 is 9 in each case. The reader will remember that I mentioned earlier in the book that in the city of the initiates 9 was considered an especially auspicious number to spend a few hours studying the mechanism of meditation which I have described in an earlier book, and then left the monastery with much sadness in my heart. Were not nearly all these poor people in the same position as Naabu? They wanted to be saved and tried to save others. And while they were looking for salvation, their poor beings disintegrated more and more. Their soul consciousness decreased. Oh, the dreadful tragedy of being unable to help them. Trouble followed trouble. It was as if some mysterious hand was putting obstacles in my way. The following morning I met with a gang of brigands. I saw them too late, and when they searched my belongings they confiscated one of the things I needed most, a thin blanket made of fine wool. None of the many brigands I had met earlier had had the heart to take the blanket away from me, who to all appearances was a poor lonely traveler. But these brigands were tougher and much less considerate. I had a faint idea that they were really lamas and carried on the brigand profession as a sideline. On another occasion I had recognized a robber in the robe of a lama when visiting a monastery after having been robbed. The Tibetans hold the lamas in high esteem and do not even dare to look at them, which must greatly facilitate this double profession. I wonder whether the 108 holy books of the Kanjur contain a passage reading your left hand should ignore what your right hand is doing, the first part of the Tibetan Bible. If it does, the lamas may have no difficulty in absolving themselves from the sin of robbery. I spent one of my worst nights. I had no blanket and the temperature in the small hours was not much higher than about 18 degrees Fahrenheit. As if by another coincidence, the coldest night in many weeks had come on just after my blanket had been confiscated. The cold of such Tibetan nights strikingly contrasts with the generous sunshine and hot weather usually raining and cloudless summer afternoons. Although I know how to protect myself from cold by keeping my muscles and chest entirely relaxed, there are limits to physical endurance. Lying motionless for hours in an unheated tent at about 18 degrees Fahrenheit when only his no blanket is more than anyone can bear. From time to time I galloped round outside the tent in wide circles, and then lay crumpled up within like a child in the womb of its mother. I had not a wink of sleep all that night. Then the sun rose, and all was bright again. Is there anything that symbolizes the Creator better than the sun, which generously gives warmth and life to all those who do not keep out its radiancy by their own free will? The sun is generous and majestic, and yet keeps his distance from those for whom he shines. He who looks full into the sun may be struck with blindness. The same applies to the creature who wants to father Creator. If you wish to be too much like him, if you wish to reach out into the domain beyond the reach of the creature, you strike yourself with spiritual blindness and mistake the moon for the sun. I walked on as fast as I could. I had no blanket, and a few dreadfully cold nights were before me. I was only about 150 miles from the abode of the wise hermit whose brother I had met, south of the Gobi desert. I had asked the latter whether great spiritual teachers lived on the way so that I might visit them when passing the respective districts. He had not mentioned the city of which I had learned only through my acquaintance with Dolma and Narbu, but had talked about a great spiritual teacher to whom I might listen. He lived on a high mountain which I would pass a few days before reaching the district where several hermits, including his brother, lived. Does he serve light or darkness? I had asked him. I cannot tell you that, he had replied. You must discover it for yourself. Is it not your spiritual duty to warn me of demons who may easily appear in the disguise of angels, as occasionally happens in Western countries? I had asked further. No, he had said, even if I realized their nature myself, it is a man's highest spiritual duty to respect another man's spiritual freedom. By cataloguing spiritual teachers and telling you who is the evil one and who is not, I should influence your spiritual attitude. You must discover things for yourself. You are going to Tibet. You have to take the risks, not I. His answer had been very firm. I walked all morning, and then slept during many hours in the afternoon. I awoke feeling a very strange kind of pain in the region of the heart. I examined myself medically in a thorough manner, even devising an emergency stethoscope for the occasion, but found that there was absolutely nothing wrong with me, and I think no specialist, had he been present, could have discovered anything either. Yet the pain was rather violent, as though an invisible hand was directing piercing stabs against my heart. So it was either a case of autosuggestion. I wished to God it was, or the work of those confounded sorcerers in the city. I knew that magical processes of this kind lose the largest part of their vigor after 5 days, and eagerly anticipated the time when 5 clear days would have lapsed since I had left the holy city. Evening came, and I greatly regretted the impossibility of walking on in the darkness, since the countryside became more and more mountainous. After another dreadfully cold night spent in an unheated tent without a blanket at a temperature that was many degrees under freezing point, I felt so tired that I fell asleep soon after sunrise. Late in the forenoon I again started at top speed and, after having consulted the sketch drawn by the hermit, I knew that only a few miles separated me from the mountain on which the great spiritual teacher lived. My hermit friend had told me that he refused to bear any title, that he lived very simply, without making any effort at being simple, that his simplicity in itself may be a pose. The author has occasionally found humble people to be even more irritating than strutting and blustering folk. Had no special circle of disciples or followers, and that he always stressed the necessity that people should follow the light of their own intelligence and not allow themselves to be influenced by anyone else. In short, he seemed to be the very reverse of the prince in the city and, needless to say, I was rather inclined to consider him as a sincere teacher, although I reserved my opinion until I had actually met him and his followers. He was known by the name of Gentle Friend, and according to what my hermit friend had told me before I entered Tibet, many Tibetans interested in Dhalsbug principles were amongst his regular visitors. About 500 yards before I reached his abode, the Gentle Friend, as I had been told, never travelled, and was always at home. I met a nice young Tibetan and asked him whether he knew where the Tsenpe Chenpo, great teacher, lived. "Lags, lags," he answered, "his Kanpo is over there. About 20 people live with him here at present, some of them in the Kanpo and others in Fugs close by." "Who has asked you to come here?" "No one in particular," I answered, "but a friend of mine who lives south of the Gobi Desert mentioned to me his teaching and I am interested in it." "I at once knew by your accent," he observed, "that you come from very far, and probably from a remote part in the north. A teaching which recommends the elimination of all passion in life and the cool judging of things in an impersonal way." "T.S. Yes. House. Section, a kind of den." "You are right," I said. We arrived at the house and I asked to see the Gentle Friend. I was told that the teacher had nothing special to say to visitors, but if I was interested in his teaching, there was no objection to my listening to a few of his lectures. The teacher was for everyone and not for private persons. No one stood nearer to the Gentle Friend than anyone in the multitude, and that is why he did not receive visitors. If I wanted to come next morning, I should be welcome. I could live in any of the unoccupied dens I liked to choose, and if I had not food and fuel enough, I could get some barley meal and dried yak dung in the house. Decidedly, I began to like this place. Everything seemed to be so simple, matter of fact, and unobtrusive. It seemed to be the very opposite of that dreadful city. The following morning I met some of the guests who lived in the other dens. It was a rather motley crowd belonging to various walks of life. There were even a few tradesmen who had come a long way from an important trading center to stay on the mountain of simplicity. The guests were all deeply interested in religious matters and most of them seemed to be possessed of an unusual amount of intelligence. However, they were not much cleaner than other Tibetans in similar conditions. "Where is your Khyentser?" was one of the first questions. The young man I had met the day before told them native place all he knew about me. He said that I was a truth seeker and my attention had been called to the mountain of simplicity by a Drogban, living south of the Gobi Desert. This remark created quite a sensation, since only few people had ever visited the mountain who came from so enormously distant a place. Some people observed that there was a very queer smell about me. I had noticed it myself. It was as if I carried dead mice in my pocket, but I could not help it. The little crowd was keenly interested in abstract problems. While we were walking up to the Kanpa / for the lecture, they discussed the problems of good and evil, light and shadow, with great animation. For them it seemed good and evil did not exist at all. There was no such thing as bad, one of them observed, and all the others agreed to it. Everything was a mere reflection of ourselves. I inwardly disagreed. I thought of the dreadful city I had left a few days before. I knew for a fact that such a thing as evil in itself existed. No amount of philosophy could discuss the devil away and the obvious polarity of nature. We entered the house of simplicity. It was none too clean. We sat down on mattresses. Soon afterwards the room filled up with other people and when about 20 to 25 had gathered for the lecture, the outer door was closed and bolted and the Gentle Friend, a good friend, F. House, whom everyone seemed to regard as a great spiritual teacher, entered. I compared him with the spiritual head of the city. He seemed to be the very opposite in appearance. Whereas the prince or exalted jewel had been the very picture of majesty, this man seemed to be a picture of humility. He was unostentatiously dressed in a cheap and almost shabby chupa. His face was kind and gentle and looked the very embodiment of renouncement, unselfishness, and happiness. He was rather old, and his body perhaps a trifle too stout. His imbon point in all probability being due to lack of exercise. As I said before, he never travelled. I had had so many spiritual surprises in my life, I had just had the greatest in the city, that I entirely reserved my opinion of him until I had heard him lecture several times, and studied those who listened to him. All this, I imagined, would take several days. As I had a full month left for studying the Tibetan hermits and rispas, which was the final stage of my travels in the country, I decided to sacrifice 2 to 3 days to find out all about the gentle friend, and the mountain of simplicity. The teacher started his lecture by directing attention to the utter futility of conscious spiritual guidance. Everyone, he said, must be his own spiritual light and his own guide. Spirituality could not be done, he said, and stressed the teosites who can sit naked and motionless for hours in icily cold weather without freezing to death, tea given dot word several times. It was always there. Man had to take it by perfecting himself, and the way to this perfection was reached by introspection, that is to say, by understanding own self and by discovering the real value of things. The longer he talked, the better I liked him. There seemed to be so much common sense and sincerity about this man. During the lecture, enormous rats seemed to play a kind of football match on the roof of the house. They greatly disturbed the talk by doing so, but the gentle friend and most of his listeners loved animals, all animals, and did not allow anyone to fight or chase rats or any other creature. Non-resistance to everything, as I learned a little later, was the keynote of their whole existence, and this non-resistance included a passive attitude to animals of any kind. I respectfully disagreed with the gentle friend in this respect. There were obviously two realms of animals in nature. If I was kind to a horse or a dog, and in exceptional cases even to a bear or a squirrel, the kindness would be justified. But how about kindness to parasites, to snakes, to crocodiles or sharks? The latter animals belonged to a different branch of life. No amount of love, kindness, and non-resistance would ever disarm a shark or a louse, I thought. Was it not a crime then to eat, because the food taken by the gentle friend and our circle could have fed many more rats? Surely many of them were hungry, for rats and other parasitic animals always multiply a little faster than the food supply available for them could justify, so that they always need more food. Life is a struggle. In this struggle, a just and equitable balance can be kept between man and animals of the non-parasitic type, but the animals belonging to the descending branch of life, such as gnats, mosquitoes, rats, mice, flies, etc., must have fought. I wondered whether the gentle friend would also object to disinfection during epidemics out of kindness to germs of disease if he happened to come to the West. However, apart from this disregard for the elementary fact of polarity in life which led to this absurd kindness to rats, I quite agreed with him as to most of what he had said about spiritual matters and the necessity for man to be independent from visible guidance in spiritual matters. He did not answer any questions after the lecture, but there was considerable discussion amongst the members of the circle after he had left the room. The teacher gave a second lecture in the afternoon. He began by taking a strong stand against asceticism and snin as to obtain spiritual results, and I again heartily agreed with him. He then took up the subject of magic, and said it was not only a contag, but a veritable crime. The only way to salvation, he went on, was through the disappearance of Timug. Man must discard his separate spiritual existence, observed by fasting. Spiritual error. Ignorance, stupidity. The gentle friend with great vigor. And this result is reached by introspection, that is to say by giving up what I consider the most divine thing in man, his will. The idea struck me that to try to be like God by entirely destroying one's I consciousness amounts to committing spiritual suicide. Annihilation could not be the supreme goal of life. Just as in material things as much egotism is justified as is absolutely necessary to maintain a separate existence, it is the duty of the creature to maintain its individuality also in the realm of spirituality, otherwise life would have no meaning. I profoundly disagreed with the gentle friend in this respect, although most of the things he had said in the earlier part of his lecture had been perfectly acceptable. He then went on discussing I consciousness, 2, group consciousness, and 3, divine consciousness, in which all separate consciousness was absent. He said that in prehistoric times man was not yet individualized. Man then identified himself with the clan to which he happens to belong. Today man had reached the stage of individual I consciousness, and the next step for him was to go from individual I consciousness to divine consciousness. I again could not help disagreeing. How could critically minded people swallow such an idea? Prehistoric man was group conscious. Modern man is not yet fully L conscious. Again and again he is drawn back into the clan and family spirit, that is to say, he is alternately group conscious and I conscious. So the trend of evolution in modern man is from group consciousness towards full I consciousness. And now the gentle friend proposed that man, whose I consciousness is just emerging from group consciousness, should jump back to a state of total consciousness which existed prior to group consciousness. I again thought of the fact that he recommended people to put themselves on a level with the Creator. Once more I realized a short moment of acute spiritual anguish when I realized that this man, too, served the purpose of the fallen angels, and wondered whether he was a mere tool or whether he himself was conscious of his decidedly destructive mission. How beautiful had been most of these two lectures. There had been so much truth in them, and yet they were only nearly true. The word almost in spiritual matters is an ominous one. The evil one himself is almost God, and in this little word almost lies all the dreadful difference. Perhaps the gentle friend did not realize himself what he was doing. This prospect was slight, but it existed. There are cases of this kind in spiritual life. It occasionally happens that sincere people are struck with spiritual blindness and serve the cause of darkness while they honestly believe they serve the cause of light. I returned to my fug and sat down to think over the further spiritual lesson I had received, when I had come to realize the real nature of the gentle friend. Then, late in the evening I met the young man who had been the first to show me the way to the camper the day before. He asked me how long I was going to stay, and I answered that I should leave the following day. He also had news to tell me that was rather startling. The rumor had circulated in the district that a P.I.N. had walked about alone in the disguise of a Tibetan, and that the Dzongpan / had sent out several detachments of soldiers to comb the district. If I was the person to whom the attention of the Dzongpan had been drawn, and no other Westerner happened to be traveling in the region, this difficulty may have been the deliberate work of someone in the underground city. There I had not made the slightest attempt to hide the fact that I was a Westerner. I had not even dyed my face during the 3 days I had spent in the Valley of Mystery. No rapid flight was necessary. Fortunately, about 2 days' walk at top speed would suffice to enable me to reach the region inhabited by the hermits, where I would, no doubt, receive valuable assistance and protection. I contemplated leaving immediately, But as I had announced my intention to stay just before I heard the news that a Westerner was being searched for in the district, I could not suddenly alter my decision without giving rise to suspicion. I felt some concern about the matter, all the more so as I had thrown Narbu's letter away,